welcome back to Purple Row Radio. This edition is for Friday, April the 20th, 2012. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at PurpleRow.com. And not joining us, as always, is Andrew Martin, who double-booked us and forgot to record the podcast today. So I'm stuck alone with Paul. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Greg. How about you?
Doing all right. You commented before we started recording that you are skeptical about my sincerity when I say that, but yeah.
Well, we talked through it. We worked it out. We worked out our problems.
Awesome. Okay, so this probably not going to have too much to talk about in this show. This is actually kind of the period of the season where everything kind of starts to slow down again. We kind of get like everything's booming, and there's all this news at the beginning of spring training and right at the end, and then right at the beginning of the season, and everyone's excited, and then we hit a brick wall because it's just more of the season and more and more and more and so forth.
Yeah, and it's a good point, though, this season where, like, sample sizes are still, like, too small, but the numbers are a little bit more, like, realistic, and you're not seeing someone batting, like, 617 or anything anymore. So.
Although, as of today, Jonathan Herrera is batting 364.
Right, yeah. There's always got to be someone to do that.
Well, it's just because his sample size is still super small, so.
And it would be him to ensure that he's going to get a bunch of more sporadic starts at second base.
Everybody keeps joking about that, but so far the Herrera trigger has not been overused.
Young.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Actually, that's one other subject that we can talk about. We have Troy Tulowitzki getting a little bit of off to a strange start for at least Tulowitzki standards. He's already committed as many errors in this young 2.5 week season as he did in all of last season. We're recording this on Wednesday, so this is the lineup where Tulowitzki was set on the bench for a little while, maybe to clear his head a little bit, although they say that this was a scheduled off day from quite some time ago. I was wondering if you have any thoughts about whether or not, obviously we can hope that, or assume even that Tulowitzki's not going to remain like this for long, but do you think there's anything else going on here that that might be flying under the radar?
I mean, honestly, I haven't really, like, looked into it beyond just, you know, hearing and seeing that he has a bunch of errors. With his track record, I'd assume that it's only, you know, a matter of time until he bounces back to provide elite defense. Worst case scenario, he does have a poor defensive season. You know, I think that just the same way someone could have a poor offensive season, someone could do that defensively. We tend not to think of it that way necessarily, but I think he could have a down year defensively, at which point he's what, average, you know? So
I guess it depends on how down, because, I mean, obviously at this rate, it's going to be pretty down.
I don't think this is sustainable. He can't go, like, every other day and make an error. That would be...
If we keep Jamie Moyer in the rotation, since he seems to be a magnetic source of errors, maybe Tulowitzki will just continue to have issues like that.
Possibly.
So, speaking of Jamie Moyer, and of course we just sort of are mandated in a sense to at least bring up the historic win from Jamie Moyer on Tuesday, not a whole lot more we have to say about the win itself, but the one thing I was thinking about is obviously we have Jorge De La Rosa coming back soon, and we've had all these discussions about how much the rotation has been struggling so far. You know, we obviously have Chacin and Nicasio and Pomeranz and these people who can be easily sent out if we have to, but now that the Moyer win is out of the way, how much longevity do you think he really has in the rotation? Are they going to try to take it as far as they can, or now that bit's done, is he a little bit less safe?
I don't know. I mean, I think given that the fact that he's pitched pretty well, and that, you know, the rest of the rotation hasn't really pitched too well, I think he's pretty safe. Although, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he gets knocked out of the rotation in, what, like 2 months from now when,
right.
when De La Rosa comes back. So, I mean, there's a lot of time, and things are still, what, people are sitting on, what, 3 starts total, 4 starts, something like that. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how things shake out, because if De La Rosa was coming back next week, I would have, like, no idea what to do. You know,
they'd probably just send Pomeranz back down, would be my guess. But
you think so?
Yeah. Maybe. Well, point is, thankfully, he's not coming back next week. Or actually, maybe he should be. I don't know. De La Rosa is going to be an interesting case because, while I certainly don't want to downplay the significance of "quote unquote" reacquiring him, so to speak, in the middle of the season. We don't know exactly what condition he's going to be in terms of the quality of the pitching that we're going to see from him. You know, I obviously am no expert on these things, but there seems to sort of be this back and forth wave between, oh yeah, we're really excited that we have Jorge De La Rosa coming back, and then everybody remembers, oh, but he hasn't pitched a game in a year. So I don't know. I would say I'm anticipating it, but at the same time, I don't necessarily know that he's actually going to end up being a better option, at least immediately, than anyone else we have so far.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I guess I'm optimistic about his return in a more global sense, but as far as just his actual performance and the innings he's going to give us this year, you know, I'm kind of, you know, withholding my optimism in a way. I think, you know, he'll be decent, I guess, but, you know, he never had great control to begin with. So, you know, it kind of seems like he'll come back and kind of be mediocre and then have like one start where he only walks like one person and everyone get all excited and then he'll kind of revert back to mediocrity. But I am, you know, this injury worked out pretty well for us in that I think it's unlikely that he would decline his player option.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking the same thing. I mean, that was a very interesting contract when it was signed, and I mean, obviously it made sense kind of from everyone's perspective in that he was looking for a long-term deal. We were looking for a discount of some kind from him, and it ended up being this sort of compromise where we got him for 4 years if he wants, but at the same time, we have to want all 4 years. So that's why I can't imagine there are too many contracts that have both player and team options separate from each other in the same contract.
It's like a prisoner's dilemma type of contract. You need both people to agree. Like, but you know, I think so. That's kind of why I say I'm very optimistic about his return. Because I think I'm not really worried about him being unable to come back from it. You know, I think Tommy John's surgery is pretty reliable now in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the optimistic fan part of me thinks he'll be able to get the innings and kind of, you know, figure it all out and get back to more or less the De La Rosa that we know. I don't really expect it to be this season, but I think that sets us up perfectly for next season, and we'll have, you know, him back and, you know, added years of growth from Pomeranz or White or Friedrich now or whoever, and then Arenado, you know, so I think it's setting us up pretty well for next year.
Of course, we hope that De La Rosa actually has a really fantastic return and ends up in a position to decline that player option. It's kind of a double-edged sword there. I mean, obviously, looking at the available options, other than Guthrie and other than just Guthrie, De La Rosa sort of has the most stable feeling to him as like an established major league pitcher. And I mean, I was about to say Jamie Moyer, but I can't help but get the impression that all of us are just a little nervous that he's just going to like turn to dust on the mound one of these days. It'll be great if we can just get him back to eight innings, but at the same time, if he comes back and he's immediately in top form and he goes out there and kind of usurps that top of the rotation spot, then he's probably going to be at least considering not taking up that option there if he thinks he can get a better deal than what we gave him already.
That would be interesting. Like, is there a team that's going to be out there willing to give him something like substantially better than what he has based off of, I mean, what, like
two-thirds of a good season? Yeah.
Maybe, you know.
I think he'll probably get to more than that, assuming he comes back in early June. If his rehab gets delayed, then that might become more of an issue. I definitely agree that it weighs heavily in the favor of him accepting the player option, especially he's going to be in sort of a, even if he succeeds, he'll be in a weaker negotiating spot. But at the same time, left-handed starters are always sought after, so.
You know what else is actually a factor too. I haven't looked into it recently, but I'm pretty sure this free agent crop of pitchers, although now that Danks in Chicago and Matt Cain have signed extensions, that takes a bite out of it, and if Greinke does too, then maybe. But you know, he wouldn't be necessarily like the top arm that's out there, but
No. And he wasn't really the top arm, during his last one either, but he was up there probably higher than normal. It seems to me, I haven't really paid too close attention to this or actually looked into it with any, depth, but it does seem like there are fewer and fewer players at certain positions that are hitting free agency. And of course, third base kind of makes sense because, you know, last year the joke was that, what, the second best third baseman, free agent was Wilson Bedemit, and obviously there are a wide variety of reasons for that, but the biggest one is that third base production as a whole is down because, like, this entire wave of third base prospects, except for maybe Ryan Zimmerman, if you include him, he was kind of from the earlier part of that, but all kind of failed to reach that sort of expectancy. Obviously, we're familiar with Ian Stewart, but there was Brandon Wood as part of that, and let's see who else. Pedro Alvarez is still at third, I think, and I mean he's doing okay, but he's not a superstar.
Ryan Braun didn't stay at third. Right?
No,
that's another one.
No, he didn't. Now, yeah, if you watch just this game, you would love Chase Headley. So
he's
underrated. Yeah, well, I mean, when you're at third base right now in Major League Baseball and you're having success, you're probably in the top tier of third baseman, so to speak. But taking this back to the starting pitching, I wonder if there's a larger amount of sort of number three, number four area starters that are getting longer contracts because those positions seem a little bit more valuable than they used to because the paradigm has kind of shifted towards more teams valuing those starters who are consistent, even if they don't have a rotation of like three number one pitchers or something like that. If you can get 2 to 3 good middle of the rotation starters, you already have an advantage over most rotations anyway. And so I haven't really looked into it, but I'm wondering if there's more contract extensions there than there used to be.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, there's definitely been this more global trend of locking players up, and you know, kind of them missing out on their first year or two of free agency. I haven't been paying attention to starters necessarily, aside from just like the most elite guys. But that's definitely an interesting theory that wouldn't surprise me if there's some truth to it.
I should look into that. Should spend several hours doing the research, like I have time to do that. Oh my god. So let's talk a little bit about our minor league system here. We kind of touched on it last week where we talked about, Christian Friedrich, kind of returning to form, Tyler Matzek, still a little bit,
He's been returning to form.
He's headed very clearly in the right direction, but from where he was, he has a long way to go. Again, I kind of talked about this last week, so I'll keep it brief, but looking at Tyler Matzek box scores last year was always crazy because both the strikeout and walk rates would be absurdly high. You'd get box scores where he'd have like 10 walks and 9 strikeouts every game.
Yeah.
And,
8 walks, 13 strikeouts through like 5 1/3 innings.
And one hit. Yeah, it was crazy. But, there's definitely a trend more towards the normal numbers, and I mean, there's still a relatively high walk rate, but it's not super bad. I mean, he's not walking 8, he's walking 4 instead, which is, mm-hmm. is certainly a significant step in the right direction. And so far, I mean, he's made 3 starts now, and all 3 have been, if not stellar, but at least positive, and he, I mean, it's just encouraging, even though we haven't actually seen him throw, just to know that, like, there's some trending in the right direction there.
Yeah, and I think there's been some sort of interesting things, too, about the walks that he has issued where, I forget who it was, maybe it was, like, Charlie in the comments was mentioning how, you know, in his last start he might have issued, like, 3 walks, but 2 came in his last inning, so maybe he was tired.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also this fact thrown around that like he's only really walked other lefties,
huh?
Which is kind of interesting to me for some
yeah.
reason.
No,
so.
No, that's interesting to me too. Although I haven't looked into it, I don't know if that's actually what's going on. I've
yeah,
never
so,
actually really considered something like that happening, but I guess it makes sense if you have a very specific way you like to pitch to people from different sides of the plate, then. Maybe he's having more success one direction than the other. It's kind of like the opposite of the old Dexter Fowler argument. Oh, he
yeah.
should drop throwing from the left or batting from the left and so forth.
Yeah. And you know, I guess that's the type of thing too that you wouldn't really expect to see at the major league level,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it's unless maybe you're like a situational reliever, at which point you're just not going to face. You know, like an other-handed batter or whatever, but that's the type of thing that you'd have to iron out, I guess, in the minor leagues prior to making it to this level. But, you know, it kind of makes me, I mean, I guess it could be noise, but it does make me a little bit optimistic, too, that even though he's still putting up higher than ideal walk numbers, that it's kind of on shaky ground and that he'll be able to kind of improve his control, you know, more than we might normally expect.
Obviously, what the team should do is tinker with him even more and turn him into a switch pitcher.
Yeah, yeah, or just make him throw a righty or something, or hit the ball.
Tyler Matzek remains a starting pitcher and throws only to right-handed batters. As soon as there's one lefty in the lineup, he's removed for a left-handed reliever. start the game for 2/3 of an inning. Yeah.
But you know, this talking about the minor leagues, this... The way things have been going lately, it kind of reinforces what I've either said or just thought, which is basically that the best move that the Rockies made this offseason is getting a humidor in AAA.
Yeah, that's huge. And I mean, so far they've only played one series there at this point, but it's huge that so far it seems to be making a pretty significant difference. And I mean, obviously. In that league, which is still going to be a very heavily offensive league, there's still going to be concerns regarding pitching performance and so forth. As mm-hmm. I mean, there's more than just Colorado Springs in that league that trend heavily towards the offense.
Yeah, Albuquerque,
uh-huh.
Las Vegas, yeah.
And so it just feels. I remember last August or so there was. In fact, yeah, it was right around when we started when we got Pomeranz and White in the Jimenez trade, and everyone was trying to project where these guys were going to be through the rest of the season and then going into 2012, and there just suddenly was this huge backlash against Colorado Springs because at this point we were
no one wanted him there.
Yeah, we were terrified that sending our pitchers to Colorado Springs was going to destroy them, and then there was also this sort of backlash to the backlash where we suddenly decided we didn't want our best batters there either because they were going to get lazy because it was too easy to get hits.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So suddenly we wanted an entire AAA team full of, you know, washed up Brandon Wood types and no Nolan Arenado's or Charlie Blackman's there at all.
You know, and I think the big takeaway for me too is that like, yeah, it's still Colorado Springs, right? It's still going to be high up. It's still going to be in a very offensive heavy league. But I think at this point though, it'll much more mimic Coors. And I think that's always been like a critical thing that gets overlooked is that these players need to learn how to play at altitude.
Mm-hmm.
they need to learn how to play in an environment where pitches move differently between altitude and sea level. They need to learn to get used to this altitude. They need to learn to transition between home and away games and things like that. And so I think that this is a tremendous, you know, developmental opportunity. That way, when hitters come up to the major leagues, they're not only trying to adjust to major league caliber baseball and altitude. Now they only have to worry about just major league baseball.
Right. And of course, they obviously had that same idea when they chose to keep their team at Colorado Springs. They obviously wanted it there. But now, having had the humidor in Coors now for 10 years, I think, or maybe nine, some such like that, we have basically sort of the opposite, where we train our players at AAA to almost be used to too much altitude effect. And so there was this fear that there would be an overcompensation for it. And I mean, it was almost as if, if you compare the old Coors Field to what Colorado Springs still was, that we were almost training our players to play for the Rockies in the 90s, right?
Yeah, they were being trained for something that isn't going to translate up a level.
Right.
You know, or translate very poorly, or just, you know, regardless of whether it translates to whatever information the club is getting is just really hard to decipher. It's encrypted and, you know, high altitude nonsense.
Mm. Yeah, so that's certainly been a very significant thing to watch through this minor league season so far. But we're seeing quite a bit of success from a lot of players. I mean, there's always a couple who get off to really slow starts, but I think the overall feel that people have about the minors right now is fairly positive.
I don't think we could have really, you know, aside from a couple of you know, injuries, right, to Kyle Parker and Tim Wheeler and I guess Chad Bettis, and I'm probably leaving a name out, but aside from those injuries, I don't think we could have gotten off to a better start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the minors are—it's almost like watching spring training games. Whenever you watch a minor league game, because all the players need to get a certain amount of X playing time, and the team records and so forth will often be really miserable. But the people you want to see performing are still performing. And actually, overall, I think there have been a lot of positive things to say, not only about the players that we're watching, but sort of those fringe prospects that. Actually, to get off that thought for a second, I apologize in advance for calling them fringe prospects, because I know somebody somewhere is going to be offended. We've had comments on this show, and last week I got somebody who commented on my transactions thread who got mad at me for calling the players that we released superfluous. Apparently, that was bad form on my part. But yeah, I mean, basically, every year when we go into, like, for example, the perps voting on Purple Row, it's always difficult to try and gauge, like, the last, like, 6 to 8 spots or so.
Mm-hmm.
It all sort of becomes stacked together and becomes very subjective. And, I think there are a lot of interesting players that might be sneaking their way into that bracket there this year. And so, I've definitely had a very, I want to say productive, but that's not quite the right word. I've been very pleased with what I've seen, and watching the minor league box scores and so forth has been, a lot more rewarding, I think, to the fan than it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the themes that kept kind of coming up when I was, you know, reviewing all the different type of the prospect lists put out there was that, you know, we have a couple of, like, you know, big time prospect guys that everyone would agree upon are awesome, right? Which is like Rosario, Bettis, Arenado, like Pomeranz. And then after that, the lists kind of just became very different, but there was this general feeling that despite there being no, like, sure things or really, like, you know, big time flashy prospects, there are a lot of people with a tremendous upside in the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know, best case scenario type of things happen, like there could be a tremendous amount of firepower in the system. So, you know, it's definitely encouraging, and it's definitely a good thing to kind of see that the minor league teams get off to such a rolling start here.
And I think a big part of it is we're finally starting to get past those dreadful years that were the product of the 2006 through 2008 drafts, which were all fairly weak. And then we suddenly reached 2009 and all of a sudden, hey, we have been ranked as the best draft out of any team in baseball. That was the draft we got.
That was Arenado, Brothers,
Wheeler, yeah, all those guys. And so, that's sort of the next generation right there. And, we've kind of seen what we've gotten out of those past few drafts. And I mean, 2006 and 7 especially were really, really hard. I don't know if we can count on one hand the amount of players who got pulled from those drafts and have stuck.
You know, I kind of feel like outside of just like Tulowitzki,
who was 2005, yeah.
Right. We had this stretch from like 03 or whatever through 2007-ish, where I think outside of like Tulowitzki and Chris Iannetta, you know, we didn't have a whole lot kind of really emerging. I think our first, you know, kind of shift in paradigm, you know, or whatever draft was the Friedrich run.
2008, yeah.
Yeah, because that was, you know, I remember just everyone being excited about Friedrich because he was expected to go a lot earlier and then he kind of fell and the club just like jumped on him, mm-hmm. things like that. And just a radical departure from taking Casey Weathers first overall, which, you know, no disrespect to Casey Weathers, but it's, you can't really take a reliever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unless it's like an unprotected pick, which it wasn't. So
right, or you have, obviously you could take somebody who you might plan to turn into a reliever at some point, but I think at that point Casey Weathers was a reliever. Like
Casey Weathers was like, he was an outfielder who started pitching somewhere in college and then was now a first round, you know, relief prospect.
Yeah, I'm navigating through Baseball Reference right now to see what we got out of these drafts, and not a lot of. I'm looking at the 2007 draft right now. We have had 5 players we drafted that year have reached the majors, and only 3 of them are were actually signed with the Rockies. And
is that the draft where like the cream of the crop is like Jordan Pacheco now.
That's
2007.
Yeah, let's look at the top 5 draft picks here. We have Casey Weathers, right? Casey Weathers was traded to the Cubs and then outrighted off of their roster. Brian Reich was pick number 2. He's currently in extended spring training. Lars Davis was pick number 3. He's been catcher at AA for 3 years now. Isaiah Fronberger was pick number 4. He's had some injury issues and hasn't progressed very quickly through the system. And then number 5 is Connor Graham, who was traded to Cleveland for Rafael Betancourt, was recently re-signed by the Rockies only to be released again. And then we have Corey Riordan, Jeff Cunningham, who retired, Parker Frazier. So yeah, pick number 9 at Jordan Pacheco is our best prize out of there. And of course, in terms of if you're looking at wins above replacement or something like that, Matt Reynolds is the prize of the draft so far with a positive 1.3 wins above replacement at pick number 20. So,
The issue with the team is that I think we do a pretty good job of getting value in later rounds, but we've just kind of missed out to get this explosive like first round firepower, mm-hmm. you know, the type of thing that like led the Giants to where they were. They lucked out like 3 years in a row.
Would you care to wager a guess on how many players the Rockies have from the 2006 draft who have reached the major leagues?
Like still with them?
Sure. Still with them, sure.
So, what are we talking, in the organization or on the major league roster, on the 40-man?
Anybody who has played a major league game that is that is currently with the Rockies from 2006.
I don't know, like 2 people.
No, that would be 0. Greg Reynolds is gone, traded to Texas. Mike McHenry is gone. And those are the only two who reached the majors with the Rockies out of the entire 50 players. Wow.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to more positive things.
Okay, like what? With
Edward Cabrera being the man.
Ooh, that's right. I almost didn't mention this, which is funny because I wrote the Pebble report about this. We had Edward Cabrera, left-handed pitching prospect at Double A Tulsa, was three outs away from a perfect game. It was pretty fun to pay attention to, actually. I was more invested in that game than the actual Rockies game at that point, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's always fun to see that sort of thing come close. It would have been the first perfect game in Tulsa Drillers history, and you really don't hear about a lot of games like that happening in the minors at all. So
no, there's one that like creeps up every year where someone has a perfect game or like a no hitter, but like kind of no one really cares.
We had who was it? The guy who went to
Bruce Billings?
No, the guy who went to Chicago White Sox. It wasn't Connor Graham. Someone like Connor Graham, but not Connor Graham. Maybe they were from this 2006 draft.
Maybe.
Yeah. Pick number 8, 2006, Brandon Hynek. Brandon Hynek threw a perfect game for 7 innings. And it counted as a perfect game because it was a 7-inning game. It was part of a doubleheader.
Yeah.
So I mean, it doesn't have the full 9 innings, but that's still pretty awesome.
That kind of sucks though if you're the guy who threw the 7-inning perfect game.
I guess, yeah.
Because you like now you have this attached to you where you threw a perfect game, but then people they're like, you mm-hmm. kind of did. But yeah, Edward Cabrera had an excellent start, and he's gotten off to you know as good a start as you could have as one could have really hoped for, and that was always the big question with him, and it's obviously too early in the season to say anything definitively one way or the other. But the big question with him was that like yeah he's been awesome in like low A ball or A ball, so we want to see how his stuff plays up at higher levels,
mm-hmm.
and he's still gonna have to fight that until he's had success in the majors. But you know this is definitely you know a great start.
Absolutely, and we actually kind of got into this discussion in the Rock Pile today. People were comparing him to Juan Nicasio. They have sort of similar track record in the sense that they're both players
older.
Right. You're used to the players who came up through the Latin system sort of being super young because they're all signed at 16.
Yeah.
But these are guys who waited until 18, 19 to sign. And people keep saying like, oh, they're old for their level. Well, I mean, I really don't like it when people say that when there's no merit for it, because there's always a context, right? If you sign when you're 19 and you're a little bit slower than the rest of your class, it doesn't necessarily ruin or diminish your value at all. It just means they're going to have to pay extra attention to developing you. And it means obviously that in theory, maybe you're going to have them for a couple fewer years at the major league level. Although now we have pitchers pitching until they're 50. So who knows where that's going to go. But, not to get too far off the subject, but, going back to Jamie Moyer, I keep thinking everyone's always saying like, when you listen to the interviews with the other Rockies in the clubhouse, everyone was like, oh, this is going to be so special. Nobody's going to ever do this again. But I'm just waiting until like 7 years from now, there's some medical breakthrough and pitchers can keep pitching until they're like 65 because their arms won't fall off.
It's going to be Barry Zito. Barry Zito is the one who's going to do this.
Okay. Yeah.
He'll pitch till forever.
We'll all be like 45 and he'll still be pitching for like the Marlins or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that just feeds right back into a lot of exciting stories from the minor leagues thus far. And, I'm hoping that it doesn't stay sort of focused on the minors because ever since that we kind of started blowing up the team in the off season, people started getting really nervous about thinking that this was just going to be a throwaway year. But I mean, honestly, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on everywhere. And so I think even if we don't reach a level of success that we would like as fans, this is still going to be a much more interesting season than last year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of the, the idea that, or the reason that people were focusing on the minor leagues so much was that, you know, the club kind of got off to an uninspired start, but they've been picking it up lately. Even if they're not winning, they've been showing signs of life, right? There's not been the three-hit Barry Zito shutout, right, type of game. So at least, you know, that's always kind of my thing, where it's like, if you're going to lose, at least make it interesting.
Yeah, well, and
so they've been doing that
more. We've also had some really interesting wins, and we've quite a few of the games that we've played, with maybe one or two exceptions, we actually started off behind and still managed to come back. So at the very least, even though the team looks far from in tip-top shape right now, there aren't any real situations where we're just looking dead all the way through the game, Barry Zito game accepted.
Yeah, and I think in today's game, Wednesday's game, I think the broadcaster said something like, this is like the first or the second time that the Rockies, or maybe it was last night's game rather with Jamie Moyer, that it was the first time that they've led like the whole game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so things are definitely swinging around. Yeah.
Cool. Well, hopefully we're in for an exciting season, and maybe a season that will have even more interesting stories to fill up 35 minutes of a podcast.
Total organization domination. There you go.
Okay.
All levels.
Wouldn't that be fascinating if, like, the team that won the World Series also had every one of its minor league affiliates win the championship? That would
all their prospects were, like, awesome.
And then, like, yeah, they're such a powerful organization that they can literally say, like, okay, we will trade you our entire California League affiliate for Albert Pujols.
Something.
Yeah. Weird. All right, so we're at 36 minutes. That's more than enough time, I think, unless you've got anything else for us.
Nope.
I have to go post an overflow thread in the game thread, so I actually have something to go do. Yay.
Nice.
I just realized that last week we actually had Andrew run off at the end of the show to get dinner. I'm pretty sure he's still there. That's
he's ran off.
That's why he hasn't joined us today. He's just enjoying that food from last week so much.
More power to him, man. I do the same thing.
Awesome. Leftovers, man. Okay, so 37 minutes. That's a perfect cutoff time. We will be back next week. I'm not sure why that's a perfect cutoff time. We will be back next week on Friday the 27th, possibly with Andrew. Until then, take care.